From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we hear about efforts to solve the complex issue of the high incarceration rate of Black men in Milwaukee and how statistics inform our understanding of crime. Then what wearing denim has to do with raising awareness about sexual assault.
Why am I wearing jeans? Because this day has meaning, because we stand with survivors, because we're saying enough, not in this city, not on our campus, not in our circle.
Plus, Earth Week is underway, and we'll learn about an underappreciated part of ecology, acoustic ecology.
I mean, when you think about it, close your eyes, what do you hear? What do you hear outside? What do you hear inside? And what parts of the world do we hear more of now? And what parts of the world do we hear less of?
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Since late last year, Lake Effect and WUWM News have been examining the causes and impacts of the high rate of incarceration of African-American men in Milwaukee. Wisconsin incarcerates a higher percentage of Black men than any other state in the country. As our Project Milwaukee series continues, the conversation is shifting to solutions to the issue. Today, we meet two Milwaukee community organizers who are working to help former inmates reintegrate into the community and potentially help keep some people from being incarcerated in the first place. Joseph L. Wanger and R. L. McNeely are members of the Felmers Cheney Correctional Center Community Advisory Board. L. Wanger is a retired pastor who's worked with the organization called Wisdom and the 11 by 15 campaign to reduce Wisconsin's prison population. McNeely is an attorney and former UWM social welfare professor. Helping to guide our conversation today on Department of Correction policies and how they impact this dynamic is our Real Talk contributor, David Pate. He's a current professor in the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM. Pate tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce more about what they hope to explore.
There has been a lot of discussion on the issue of incarceration and its effects, but there hasn't really been a discussion on what is the policies and procedures effects of DOC on these men and their families, but also what has been the effect of the statistics on employment as well as in attracting employers to Milwaukee. So I'm going to ask my two guests today to kind of give us an explanation of that and talk about more how we can look at it from a bird's eye view of what does it really mean when you look at the men you're working with daily in Felmers Cheney, but also what does it mean when you think about it over a long haul, which has been something these two experts have done.
Well, Joe, RL, let me have you both start by telling us a little bit more about Felmers Cheney Correctional Center Community Advisory Board, which you both serve on.
Well, first of all, let's say what Felmers Cheney is. That is a minimum security correctional center that houses about 105 men who are toward the end of their sentences. They have about 6 months or maybe as much as up to a year left on their sentence. And what happens when they come to Felmers Cheney, they are able to seek employment and actually work on a job, come back to the center after working hours. It is indeed a prison, but a minimum security prison, the focus of which is to help these men reintegrate with their families and their communities.
Joe Elwinger, why is this so important to have this step?
It really theoretically and in some cases actually gives the men a leg up, because if they come out of prison, as many do still to this day, just with the box of clothes and books that they have and a wave, or maybe they don't even get a wave from the guards at the prison, the chances of succeeding and really reentering society positively are much higher if you've got a job and a place to stay, in contrast to somebody who has no job and maybe doesn't even know for sure where they're going to stay.
How does what you have observed at Felmers Cheney fit into the broader trend of the disproportionately high rate of incarceration of Black men in Wisconsin? What needs to change? What policies do we need to address to bring this more in line?
Definitely, treatment alternatives and diversionary programming on the front end is one of the most important ways of reducing expenditures and – increasing successful reentry into the community and the ability to keep a job. Mm-hmm. If a person has an underlying drug or alcohol addiction issue and is not likely to be guilty of a violent crime, is sent to treatment. He's going to have his toes kept to the fire. If he doesn't work his treatment program, if he's playing games, he will have to go spend his time in prison and take his sentencing. But if he works the program and stays in recovery, he, in fact, avoids incarceration. Because if we don't deal with those underlying issues and we put somebody into prison for 5 years, 10 years, they come out, they still have the addiction, they reoffend, they go back in, they come out, it's a revolving door. And so it's the most important way of bringing down incarceration expenses and raising the success ratio of keeping people out of prison. Wisconsin is, in fact, beginning to pick up on that reality, and they passed a law called Treatment Alternatives and Diversionary Programs back in 2005, funded it to the tune of $1 million, which is really a drop in the bucket, but discovered finally this budget go-around that, A, it's saving $2 or saved for every dollar that's spent in treatment alternatives and diversionary programming, and it's reducing prison population in the process. We actually had a reduction in prison population by 1,000, 1,500 a year ago that has been the first reduction in something like 80 or 90 years. And that was all because of these treatment alternatives and diversionary programs on the front end that can make really good sense. And there are states, conservative states like Texas and Georgia, that have learned this lesson and are putting millions of dollars into treatment alternatives. And Wisconsin is very slow. We did add $3 million in this budget cycle to the treatment alternatives and diversionary program. So now we're up to $4 million total.
R.L.?
There's another major motivator to do something, have the Department of Corrections be more effective, and that is the budget for incarceration is mammoth. Some people are thinking it might, in fact, lead us down the path to bankruptcy. I've forgotten now exactly what it is, but I think it's about $630 million a year.
Try $1.4 billion. You're thinking of Minnesota, which shows us the way to go. We're spending $1.4 billion. We're spending twice as much as Minnesota because Minnesota keeps people in the community. If they're not a danger to the community, they find programs for them to deal with their underlying issues, and we put them in prison, and that costs us 2, 3, 4 times as much.
Well, the point is these are some mammoth dollars that are being spent, and we need to figure out ways to not have such a negative impact on the state's budget.
One of the things you talked about in terms of looking at how we could be different in Wisconsin versus in Minnesota or somewhere else, you talked about alternatives to revocation. Is that a policy you would recommend? Or
And define that for us.
Yes.
ATR,
okay.
Alternatives to revocation, is dealing with the back end. When people come out, now this is certainly a huge area for incarceration, precisely because we have about a 50% recidivism rate, and that means that after you come out of prison, you go back in. That's recidivism. And unfortunately, 50% roughly is the percentage of people who, when they come out of prison, they're back in within a year or two. And how do we reduce that? The Wisconsin Department of Corrections has, in the last 3 or 4 years, begun to emphasize reentry. In fact, they have a plaque up in every one of their prisons now that says reentry is the way to go. It's something like that. In other words, they really have gone bonkers in emphasizing reentry. And that's easier said than done.
I was going to say, I feel like we hear from men who've been formerly incarcerated saying that there isn't the help that they need to reenter their communities in a positive way.
Well, one thing I was going to mention, the good reverend said that we've gone, or DOC has gone bonkers on reintegration. I think I'd like to put that in a little different perspective. They've said it nominally in terms of the actual policies and procedures. They don't follow through. They have, in our view, they have not followed through on that stated commitment to reintegration. For one thing, they don't collect the kind of data that would aid in the kind of planning that would fine-tune programs designed to enhance reintegration. We've had conversations with DOC executive leadership, and they've claimed to us that they don't collect revocation data that would be based on race. In other words, hey, let's find some revocation data that is race categorized based on the nature of the revocation. In other words, are these really minor rule infractions that are going on? You know, in terms of people going back to prison, like being late for an appointment with your probation agent, let's get some information on the length of revocations. Is there a disparity there by race? And as Joe was saying, alternatives to revocation, the racial background of the agent, all of these things are things that we need to have information on, yet DOC claims that this sort of information, which should be public information, they don't collect. Well, that actually is a handicap to planning to make your programs as effective as they can be.
And again, the DOC, Department of Corrections, has on the surface recognized that revoking people, especially for minor infractions of the parole agreement and not a new crime. By the way, there are some states that actually have passed legislation that say that no one is to be sent back and have their sentence revoked purely on a violation of the parole agreement. But the Department of Corrections does recognize that sending back people and revoking, especially for minor infractions of the parole agreement, is not the wisest thing to do. And so they now emphasize ATRs, alternatives to revocation. And what are they? Well, if the person, let's say, got drunk and relapsed in their recovery program, they would say, okay, instead of sending them back to prison for the rest of their sentence, let's send them to a treatment program. But how do they do it? They put the person into incarceration again and have them wait until there is a treatment program in prison. They can spend 6 months waiting for the treatment program and then another 6 months in the treatment program. So they may be going back for a whole year, which is not exactly what alternatives to revocation ought to be. Furthermore, treatment programs in prison are less effective than treatment programs in the community for some very valid reasons. A holistic treatment program in the community is going to connect someone with a job, connect someone back with family. It's not in the bubble of incarceration. And so the idea of an alternative to revoking someone is great, but it should be a community-based treatment program rather than a prison-based treatment program.
Let's say a person has an appointment scheduled with their agent but strays by being at their mother's birthday party an hour too long. Well, it's very possible that that person will find themselves on a three-day hold. That's where you're actually in custody for 3 days. What happens during those 3 days? Well, the person loses his job. The person may even lose the housing because they've lost the job and they can't pay the rent. Now, does that sound like it's a reasonable thing for you? We're talking about minor infractions here. We're not talking about any sort of substantial criminal activity. Those people, they should go back to prison. But for minor rule violations to have that sort of consequence is very inconsistent with truly focusing on reintegration as DOC's, Department of Corrections, mission says that they're doing. That's counterproductive to achieving the desirable mission that it says to the public it's seeking to achieve.
Do we know how often this is actually happening, that men are being sent back to prison for these minor infractions? Or is this what you were talking about before, RL, where we just don't know because we don't have the data?
Well, of course, DOC doesn't want to give you that sort of data. They claim that they don't have it. We've been told that they do. But I don't know. However, I do know this. One of the things that happens with the Cheney Advisory Board is that people in corrections anonymously contact us to share with us information. And this is one of the things that we're most often contacted about. And based upon the context that we have with this, I'd have to say that this is a pretty substantial problem.
Arnold, would you think that it's based on this conversation, and Joe, it's based on this conversation, it seems to me that either DOC is nervous about press, so they're a lot harsher, and they make these judgments based on you made a mistake, now you have to suffer the consequence. Is that the reason why we have such harsh? It seems very harsh. What is the reason?
One of the things that DOC needs to take into account is what's called acceptable minimum risk. There are ways where you have minimized risk. For example, at the Cheney Center, we have virtually no recidivism. It's about 5% as far as we can assess it. That's very low, and we're talking about over a period of years. It has steadily declined as we've introduced more of these measures that we've talked about. And here's the real key. Not a single walk away, to our knowledge, has ever engaged in any criminal activity. Not one. It was all little stuff like what I described. So I wanted to be at my daughter's birthday party. So I stayed, and, well, there you go.
You know, another factor here is the parole officer. When they're out in the community under supervision, that means they're out of the Cheney Center and they're on parole. The PO, the parole officer, and they've got a tough job. They are trained to be very, very careful about any of these infractions because if anything happens and they do commit a crime, then you're going to get blamed for it. And so most POs are extremely, almost paranoid about something happening on their watch. And so they're quick to catch the parolee at any small infraction of the rules, instead of emphasizing as a good parole officer or social worker, I'm going to help this person succeed. Instead, it's I've got to watch very carefully. So all of that works against the parolee being able to make it without being caught and sent back for revocation possibly.
So we're out of time here, gentlemen.
We at least scratched the surface.
Yes.
That's what we did today.
We scratched the surface. We'll have to do it again.
Okay. RL, Joe, David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Joseph L. Wanger is a former pastor for Lutheran congregations in Birmingham, Alabama, and in Milwaukee, who also served as an organizer for Wisdom, a Wisconsin network of congregations working to reduce the state's prison population. R.L. McNeely is an attorney with the Germantown-based Midwest Legal Center. He's also professor emeritus of social welfare at UW-Milwaukee. Both are members of the Felmers Cheney Correctional Center Community Advisory Board, and they joined Stephanie Lecce and Lake Effect's Real Talk contributor David Pate, who is a professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM. At the heart of the Project Milwaukee series is the statistic showing Wisconsin as having the highest rate of African-American male incarceration in the country. Lake Effect essayist Stephen Brandl says understanding crime statistics is key to understanding crime.
True or false? From 1993 to 2013, there has been nearly a 50% increase in homicides in the city of Milwaukee. The answer is false. Actually, during those years, there's been a 35% decrease in homicides in the city, from 164 to 106. That decrease has been uneven but steady. Now, if you got the answer wrong, you're not alone. Most of my criminal justice students got the question wrong, too. One of the reasons why we so often believe that homicides are on the increase is because of all of the media attention paid to this issue. Homicides grab our attention. They capture our imagination, our morbid interests. The media reflects and perpetuates this phenomenon. We must be careful in drawing conclusions about homicides based on media portrayals of them. Here are a few facts about homicide in Milwaukee in particular. First, the media doesn't pay equal attention to all homicides. What happened at the Asana Spa and the Sikh Temple grabbed the headlines but are extremely uncommon. Like plane crashes, they are rare but horrific. Truth be told, most homicides involve a young African-American male offender and a young African-American male victim. Although these homicides are tragic too, most often they barely make a ripple in the news. Second, the overwhelming majority of homicides in Milwaukee are as a result of shootings and an argument. In recent years, guns were used in about three-quarters of Milwaukee's homicides. When a homicide doesn't involve a shooting, the media shows much more interest. Consider the recent case where the pregnant mother was killed for her unborn baby. Third, the media takes special notice when there are a lot of murders. For example, in the first 5 days of 2012, there were 5 homicides in the city. The media was all over it. From June through August of last year, there were 40 homicides in Milwaukee. Again, the media, the community, and politicians demanded answers. Not long ago, when there were 122 homicides in the city, the media went into a feeding frenzy. Time magazine wrote in an article, quote, "It's as if Milwaukee, Wisconsin had reverted to a state of lethal chaos," unquote. Why? Well, the previous year there were only 88 homicides in the city. We must be aware that year-to-year comparisons in homicides are nearly completely meaningless. Multi-year trends are much more informative. Fourth, part of the reason for the year-to-year variation is that there are about 5 non-fatal shootings for every fatal one in Milwaukee. The difference between a homicide and a non-fatal shooting is often the aim of the shooter or the promptness of medical attention. Fifth, homicides in particular, and predatory crime in general, are not a random phenomenon. Homicides tend to occur, not always, but tend to occur in certain areas, at certain times, and involve victims and offenders who share certain characteristics and lifestyles. Finally, it is inaccurate to think that the police have complete control over homicides, and other crimes for that matter. The police cannot control most of the things that give rise to most homicides and other crimes. As a result, the police should not receive all the credit when homicides go down, nor should they receive the blame when homicides go up. So the bottom line here is this: don't draw conclusions about homicides based solely on media portrayals. After all, did you know that homicides in Milwaukee have gone down by 35% in the last 2 decades?
Lake Effect essayist Steve Brandl is a professor of criminal justice at UWM's Helen Bader School of Social Welfare. And while he's not a professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, he is the executive producer of Lake Effect, and he is sitting across from me now because we are into day one of our Spring into Action membership drive. Mitch Teich, welcome.
Thank you very much. This is day one. As you say, we are working towards a goal overall of $130,000, and when we reach that point, this drive will end. Let's talk about a more modest goal right now, and that is the goal during this hour of Lake Effect. We're looking for $950 to sustain this program for another year, more on into the future. Call us now with your pledge of support, 414-227-3210, or visit the website wuwm.com/give and become a member in Milwaukee Public Radio or renew your membership.
Perhaps it's time to renew and you're thinking, okay, well, you know, Earth, it's the Earth Day drive and this might be something fun. And yes, we do have have a very nice thank you gift. It is a stainless steel tumbler, a travel mug for tea or coffee or anything you'd like in your car or on the bus. And it is available to donors who contribute at least $52, or you could have a sustaining membership beginning at $5 a month. Now, that's not too much.
Not too much at all. And you think about it, it will sustain you with the amount of caffeine you need to get through your day, and you'll be sustaining us to allow us to bring you another year's worth of Lake Effect.
It's
and
a full
all the
circle.
Other exactly, and all the other programs you listen to on this public radio station. Morning Edition, All Things Considered, A Prairie Home Companion, Car Talk, what have you. Call us now, 414-227-3210, or visit the website wuwm.com/give.
Thanks, Mitch. We'll be back in a little bit, but it is Denim Day tomorrow, and you may ask how that's different from most days. Well, we'll tell you all about it when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Tomorrow in Milwaukee, students and leaders at 7 area colleges and universities will make a point of wearing blue jeans. Well, how is that different from all other days, you might ask? Well, what it is a conscious effort to bring attention to and to clear up misconceptions about sexual violence. It's part of a national effort that's spearheaded by the White House to prevent assault and to increase resources available to victims. Dr. Magda Peck is the founding dean and a professor at UWM's Joseph Zilber School of Public Health. Sue McCarthy is assistant director of the Women's Resource Center at UWM. And Dean Peck told Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke that the violence the effort is trying to prevent isn't just physical.
So according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, sexual violence is any sexual activity where consent is not freely given. And it includes either completed or attempted sex acts that are against the victim's will or involve a victim who is unable to consent. So what does that mean? That includes unwanted sexual contact. It also includes contact that is not necessarily physical, but it might be verbal sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. And it can be committed by anyone. It can be a current or former partner of yours. It could be a family member, a person in a position of power or trust. Most likely, it's going to be an acquaintance or possibly a friend. And likely, possibly still, a stranger or someone known only by sight.
And we talk about violence. We're not necessarily – obviously, as you describe it, we're not necessarily talking about somebody using a weapon. We're not necessarily talking about a physical altercation. We're talking about anything that's unwanted from a sexual standpoint.
Unwanted and coerced. You know, it's remarkable to me how common this is. It has been reported that 1 in 2 women and 1 in 5 men have experienced some form of sexual violence in their lifetime. And it is particularly prevalent on college campuses.
Well, before we get into the specifics of why we're talking about it on a campus-wide and even a city-wide perspective, let's talk about the significance of sexual violence as a public health issue. What's the significance of going after this in this manner rather than like any other advocacy issue?
What makes it a public health issue is a couple of things. The first is that we don't look at it only in terms of an individual situation. We look at it across the whole community or a whole group or a whole population. So for all women, for all men, what is the commonality of this? Because if you only look at it in terms of an individual experience, you don't have at hand the kinds of power and tools to prevent it. And prevention is the key. So public health would look at it in terms of how can you prevent the sexual assault and the sexual violence from happening. When it does happen, how can you keep it from not being so severe? And how do you keep it from causing sequela down the road? And we know that it's not just the act of violence. We do know that it can lead to long-term physical and mental health problems. Survivors may experience chronic pain, headaches, sexually transmitted diseases. They may have greater anxiety disorder, and it may lead to suicide. So it's not only about preventing the sexual assault and the sexual violence. It's about preventing a lifetime of risk and challenges.
Well, and can you talk about the specific issues surrounding sexual violence in a campus, a college campus setting?
Sure, I can speak to that, Mitch. On a college campus, sexual violence is a major problem. The president recently issued a memorandum that talked about the prevalence and the magnitude of this problem on college campuses.
This is the president of the United States.
Correct, the president of the United States. And this led to his establishment of the White House Task Force to protect students from sexual assault. And a lot of research has been done that's taken a look at what sexual assault on college campuses looks like. And what we see isn't much different from what we see nationally in respect to the fact that the vast majority of sexual assaults are committed by someone who's not a stranger to us. On the college campus, that looks like probably about 9 in 10 assaults. So 90% of assaults are at the hands of somebody who's not completely unknown to us. We also see a high prevalence of alcohol and other drugs used as a way to facilitate sexual assault. Research has really borne this out, too. The Healing Center a few years ago ran a campaign to raise awareness about alcohol as the number one acquaintance rape drug. And David Lisak is a psychologist who's done a lot of research on this topic, and he frames it as alcohol is the number one weapon used to facilitate sexual assault. And then the other thing that we found out about campus sexual assaults is that there's really a minority of individuals, primarily men, who are committing these offenses. So it's a small group of individuals who are sort of making it bad for the rest of us and who are reoffending. So what he found was that about each one of these individuals completes about 6 sexual assaults, and they're responsible for about 90% of the sexual assaults that happen on campuses.
So how do you go after an issue like that?
It's a institutional response as well as an individual response. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's been remarkable that came out of the task force out of the White House was a really clear delineation about here's an action plan, because it was indeed a call to action. It starts with looking at programs that work, prevention programs around awareness and around being able to take care of oneself. It means being able to have crisis intervention services readily available on your campus and advocacy for all victims of assault. It means you need to have on your campus a way that complaints and grievances can be made and be made with safety and security, because most survivors don't believe that anyone will take them seriously. It has to have mechanisms on your campus for proper and prompt investigation and a way to prosecute, a way to have disciplinary sanctions, mm-hmm. and a way to have training for orientation for all staff, all students and faculty. In other words, it's a whole campus effort. And if you make it be about one individual and one event, it will always continue. But if it makes it a full court press across every one of our college campuses right here in Milwaukee, we can do something about this together.
Is that a microcosm of the issue as a whole, that this is not a personal issue so much as it is a societal one?
It is a personal issue, and it's a huge societal one. In fact, if most survivors say that they won't be believed, or more importantly, that they bear some blame for the attack, that's where Denim Day comes from. The notion that if she took off her jeans, this comes from a situation which occurred in Italy a number of years ago, where because a perpetrator forced the woman to take off her tight jeans, it was interpreted in the judiciary process that she somehow was complicit and was saying yes, as opposed to being threatened. And so what we need to be able to do is to create the conditions in which women and men who are survivors of assault have the opportunity to know that someone will believe that they are not to blame, and then they'll be more likely to feel safe to come forward. Mm-hmm. Is that your experience?
I would definitely agree with you on that. I think your framing it around the individual and the social is the really important transition that we need to make. I think where we've been in the past has really been stoked in the individual and looking at it as a social problem. is a key component to addressing it effectively. I would say, too, that sexual violence also needs to be understood through the lens of oppression and that it is a tool or an instrument for oppression. And so it's also a social justice issue in that regard.
Have we made any progress? Sexual violence has awareness of it has been in the public consciousness for some time. This is not the first Denim Day observance, for example. Do you think have these efforts made a difference?
I think they make a difference for individuals who are hearing it, so for a survivor to know that there is solidarity and there are people from, you know, your neighbor next door to the mayor of Milwaukee standing with you. I think it can make a difference not so much in preventing that attack, but perhaps ameliorating or lessening the effects over time in terms of depression and in suicide and mental illness and chronic disease and pain that is a lifetime aftermath. But I don't think we've made much progress at all in terms of societal norms. In fact, mm-hmm. we have a colleague at Marquette University who is about to publish a terrific study about why it is that women won't report. And yes, we've talked about the fact that maybe they won't be believed or maybe they have a fear that they may be blamed. But the real issue is women of a certain generation are now saying that's the norm, that it happens, that that's just what guys do. Well, that's what happens when I act this way. And because it becomes socialized as something that you just have to take in stride, it makes it acceptable socially. What we need to do from a public health perspective, starting with this Denim Day and this Sexual Assault Awareness Month, is to say enough. Change the conversation and change the expectations so that it is always unacceptable.
So is there anything that the public health effort can do to address the issue of the perpetrators themselves?
We are looking to try to make a difference in how particularly men are socialized around attitudes and behavior towards women. And we're also trying to look at the consumption of alcohol and other impairing drugs that cross the line and blur the line so that behavior that you might not express goes over that line. So I think it is about raising awareness, changing the risk factors, particularly on drug and alcohol, and changing social norms.
So Denim Day asks people to wear denim jeans in support of this effort. Someone sees a large number of people wearing jeans. What should their takeaway be from this? You know, you go to work, you're wearing jeans, you see other people wearing jeans. What should you do with that after Denim Day is over?
It's a great opportunity to not only wear jeans but tell people, why am I wearing jeans? Because this day has meaning, because we stand with survivors, because we're saying enough, not in this city, not on our campus, not in our circle. We're also asking folks to take a photo of themselves or coworkers and share that message on our social media. You can post it on Twitter at Denim Day Milwaukee using the Denim Day hashtag, or you can go to the Facebook page. But the bottom line is we stand with survivors and we won't stand for anything less than a culture shift right here in Milwaukee around sexual assault.
I couldn't have said it any better. That was perfect, Magda.
Well, thank you to you both. Best of luck with this effort, and hope we'll talk to you again down the road.
Awesome.
Pleasure to be here.
Dr. Magda Peck is the founding dean and a professor at UWM's Joseph Zilber School of Public Health. Sue McCarthy is assistant director of the Women's Resource Center at UWM. Wednesday is Denim Day, an international day to call attention to the problem of sexual violence. Denim Day activities will go on tomorrow at 7 area colleges and universities, including UWM, Alverno, MATC, Mount Mary, Bryant and Stratton, Concordia, the Medical College of Wisconsin, and Marquette. There is, as always, more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And of course, there's more information there for us as well, because we are in day one of our Spring Into Action membership drive. And I'm joined in the studio by Lake Effect's executive producer, Mitch Tyke. And it's exciting. We have a $950 goal for this hour, and it's going pretty well.
An eminently makeable goal.
Yes.
And we can make it with your support right now when you call 414 414-227-3210. That's 414-227-3210. Or visit the website, wuwm.com/give. You know, let's say you have $10 a month to invest in your future. You could put the money in a bank. It would return some interest. Now, you know, I remember getting my first bank account and seeing the interest go up. And interest is a different animal than it used to be.
It doesn't go up very much.
No, exactly. and it's not very interesting. You could invest in stocks, maybe increase your return, but maybe not. Or you could invest in WUWM, and you can hear your investment grow by the meeting the people that you're introduced to every day on this program, on other programs like Fresh Air or Morning Edition. Consider becoming a sustaining member today. Call 414-227-3210 or visit the website at wuwm.com/give and hear your contribution pay off every time you listen. Become a sustaining member.
And sustaining membership also has another little advantage this time. If you are a new or continuing sustaining member, you renew your sustaining membership for at least $5 a month, you will get the Spring Into Action Membership Drive Thank You Gift. And that is a 17-ounce stainless steel tumbler. It's with a push-on lid. It's got a plastic liner, foam insulation. It's just a really nice thing. Of course, it fits into the car cup holders.
And it's 17 ounces. And what's nice about that is you can pour 16 ounces of your favorite beverage into it. And if it's a cold beverage, you add ice and there's still room for the ice to fit in. If it's a hot beverage and you add cream or sugar or whatever, it doesn't overflow. So you get the full 16-ounce effect plus some.
Plus some. And of course, the way you do that is you become a sustaining member at wuwm.com/give. You can call 414-227-3210. What matters is that you do. And this is day one of the drive. We have $130,000 to make. We don't expect to do that with one call, although that would be lovely if that happened. But once we get that $130,000, it's over. It's done. And if that happens tomorrow, then that's all.
Call us now, 414-227-3210, or visit the website, wuwm.com/give.
Well, making sound is our job in the radio business, but at least one acoustic ecologist is working hard to preserve the silent places that still exist on our planet. We'll take one more break and learn some more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect returns now. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Silence may be golden, but there's very little silence left in the world today. Gordon Hempton, an acclaimed acoustic ecologist, has traveled the globe and made it his mission to preserve the remaining quiet places. Four local nature centers have come together to bring Hempton to the Milwaukee area. He'll speak tonight at Mequon Nature Preserve and then lead silent sound tours of it, as well as at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center, the Urban Ecology Center, and the River Edge Nature Center. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz spoke with River Edge's executive director, Jessica Jens, along with Kristen Geese, who heads the Mequon Nature Center. As they walked at the Mequon Center, Geese began with its history.
Basically, what started is a substantial gift that was married up to a federal grant, and then different partners were brought in. So the Izaaki Washington Land Trust and the Greater Milwaukee Foundation was brought in to be kind of, you know, the bank and help raise awareness and donors to help make it happen. The city of Mequon was brought in basically because they had the federal grant in the place and they put in some substantial funds to also make it happen. A memorandum of understanding was written so that one day it would be transferred to the city of Mequon. So after about a decade, this 438 acres became debt-free and was transferred to the city of Mequon. In their books, it's a park. The city rents the operations, the restoration efforts, and the education to Mequon Nature Preserve Incorporated, and we're a nonprofit that makes all this happen.
So is this an unusual arrangement?
Very, very unusual, and something I think would be a really iconic model for other cities to partake in. So we hope to help educate others on how to do this.
How many acres? 300?
438. Okay. The biggest protected green space in southeastern Wisconsin.
Four work started here. I assume, well, no, that none of this obviously was here, the building.
What the building was here, it was a church. And it was renovated to be LEED certified. We went for platinum LEED, absolutely could have gotten it, would have been the first renovated building in the state of Wisconsin to hit platinum. But that also had a $50,000 price tag attached to it for the plaque and the process to go through. And a nonprofit, our budget at that time was $100,000. And there was no way I could justify to my board, hey, by the way, I want to go spend half of my budget on a plaque. So we never achieved the plaque, but we still go by the standards. So geothermal, wind, solar, and everything eco you can imagine, we've got it.
What's been added or restored in this physical space we're looking at?
Yeah, right around the building here, this 30-acre parcel, the vision was to have all the habitats represented and opportunities for the public to be inside or out. Kind of a hub, right? So we've got the outdoor amphitheater. We've got a floating boardwalk over our wetland system, a pier for some fishing, because can you believe fish spawn in these beautiful ponds? I love it. And they connect to the river, so it's just fantastic. And then about four different habitats are represented here. So the wetland system, prairie, oak savanna, and then a mature hardwood forest is started over there in Johnson's Woods. So when this all happened, really, there was about 60 acres of hardwood forest, and the rest were farmland. And so we're really about a decade into restoration. We have about 200 acres in active restoration, and another 238 are still waiting for us, so there's still farmland. So I love hiking the kids and explaining the process of restoration and baby trees, because we plant little seeds or little seedlings with them. Then we can show them what they'll look like in, oh, about some of those trees out there in waysides are 5 years, 10 years old. So this is also, though, where I should say that that's always where Mackinac Nature Preserve says, you know, come and see 4-year-old prairie and then go to River Edge and see the 45-year-old prairie or more, actually, you know, or go to Schlitz Audubon to see the 250-year-old trees, you know, as after you plant your seedling here. So it's, we, I think, are, you know, the differentiation is we're the baby, we're the beginning, we're just getting started. And then all these other nature centers that are so wonderful and out there are much further along. So it's a good complete cycle to tell the kids.
You've talked about, Kristen, yours being the baby of among these groups that you've mentioned. All of those organizations are coming together around this special Earth Day event, which must also be unique. Is that right, Jessica? And you're with River Edge.
Yes, yeah. It's a very unique opportunity to bring Gordon Hempton, an acoustic ecologist. It's something that I think really intrigues people's minds. I mean, when you think about it, close your eyes. What do you hear? What do you hear outside? What do you hear inside? And what parts of the world do we hear more of now? And what parts of the world do we hear less of? Just something that was organically grew up and everybody said yes. I mean, so kudos to everybody at the table. And what's really fun about it is it started with Gordon Hempton, but now it's cascading into something larger. We aren't really quite sure what that's going to be, but what can we as nature centers do together, and we can do better as a whole than we can do just individually. And in the next couple of months, we'll probably have something concrete to share.
I want to know now.
As we all do.
We all
want to know.
So you're not teasing us.
No. When you think of the four nature centers, Urban Ecology, Schlitz Audubon, River Edge, Mequon Nature Preserve, and so many others. So there are quite a few other nature centers in southeast Wisconsin, and we're hoping that in the future we can bring them into the collaboration as well. And so I'm really excited about the future of this collaboration. I mean, I think the sky's the limit.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's going to be amazing.
I heard, as I drove out here, I heard Jane Goodall on the radio, and then I saw a photograph of you with her, yes. Kristen, in your building. She's an icon of saving what we've got and restoring what we can. Anytime I've heard her, and again on the radio, she talked about, for her, she's an older woman. You are ever so much younger, but that, you know, for her, not only is it urgent, but her life is pushing forward, so she feels that urgency even more. I sense with you, too, that you love being out here, and it's a passion, but I'm assuming you're feeling some urgency too.
Yeah, I think the timing feels right. I mean, I would definitely say urgency is one of them, but I just think the timing is right. I mean, we have you know, maybe we're tooting our own horns, I don't know, but we've got some great executive directors at all the different nature centers. I mean, everybody gets along, and now is the time. And, you know, I think historically there was obvious competition. I mean, we'd be lying if we said we don't compete with one another for different things. But let's be honest, we're not serving everybody. We're not helping every species out there. We're not saving every chunk of land. But together we might be able to. So I think, you know, I think it's really about the timing being right, the right people in place, and the passion we all share together, yes, and support one another. I mean, it's, the conversations are fantastic at every meeting. And I can't wait to get our staffs all in the same direction. And then all of our constituents, all of our donors, and so many of them overlap anyways. It just seems right.
Mm-hmm. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bent spoke with Jessica Jens, the executive director of River Edge Nature Center, and Kristen Geese, the head of the Mequon Nature Center. Those two organizations, along with the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center and the Urban Ecology Center, are hosting the Emmy Award-winning acoustic ecologist Gordon Hempton. He'll speak at the Mequon Preserve tonight at 7 and lead silent sound tours of all four nature preserves. There's more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And there's more information at wuwm.com/give as well, because we're in day one of our membership, Mitch Teich.
It is Spring Into Action Week on WUWM. It is our spring membership drive. When we reach $130,000, this drive will end. We are in day one. You know, if we reach $130,000 in day one, we have a one-day membership drive.
Oh,
that would
be fantastic.
But we are allotting ourselves about a week to reach that. You can help us reach that goal by calling 414-227-3210 or by visiting wuwm.com/give. It's a more modest goal for this hour of Lake Effect, which is rapidly coming to a conclusion, and we are rapidly approaching that goal of $950. We can get over that hump with your support. Call 414-227-3210 or visit wuwm.com/give. And as our way of saying thank you, we have the following thank you gift.
We do indeed. This is available to anyone who contributes a gift of at least $52 or a sustaining membership beginning at $5. Of course, you can give more than that. We won't say no. But at that level and above, you will get this wonderful 17-ounce stainless steel tumbler with a push-on lid, plastic liner, foam insulation, the perfect thing to bring your hot or cold beverage of choice along with you on your commute or maybe out for the day for a walk at one of the nature centers we just heard about.
Indeed. And it's also a great way to announce to the world that this is your radio station. You are a part. You are the public in our public radio station, and you are a sustaining member. Sustaining members can join at any level. But again, if you want to receive the travel mug, it is $5 a month or more. And it means your gift is ongoing, and it helps ensure that programs like Lake Effect and Fresh Air, which is coming your way in just a few seconds, and Here and Now, which is coming your way at 12 noon, go on for the day to come.
That's right. We forgot to mention that, of course, the WUWM logo is on the mug. You know, so you are actually announcing that. It's not just a generic,
like a little walking billboard.
Exactly. So we hope that you'll take advantage of that. Go to wuwm.com/give. Call 414-227-3210. However you do it, however much you give, just become a member or renew your membership. We thank you so very much. Mitch, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you tomorrow. I am Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's all coming to you from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air comes your way next, so stay tuned.